On to our next speaker, Stephen Claxton. Stephen has a 20-plus year accomplished banking career across Asia Pacific and the United Arab Emirates. His responsibility at FIS is leading treasury and risk in Asia Pacific, which sees him working directly with banking clients to adapt FIS solutions to their strategic priorities. Stephen has worked for systemically important banks such as Standard Chartered Bank and as a consultant with KPMG. His experience stretches across value propositions such as capital measurement and planning, prudential regulation, behavioral modeling, including IFRS 9, credit, counterparty credit, operational, balance sheet, and liquidity risk. Stephen currently sits on the International Actuarial Association's Artificial Intelligence Task Force, where he is leading a workstream on how AI is changing the actuary's role across the financial sector. Please help me welcome Stephen on his session on resolution and recovery planning. He will be joining us online.
Hello, just maybe can I just confirm that you can hear me okay? I think that's a quiet yes. Excellent. Apologies, I can't be there in person, but it sounds like it's quite an interesting debate on the IRRBB topic. Just as a side note, when I was recently in Australia, it's a very hot topic given that in the Australian market, interest rate in the banking book is actually a pillar one risk. So they've currently going through their APS 117. So I'm not surprised that the topic, ignited the passions in terms of the topic. But if we now sort of go to a more, let's call it systemic risk topic, today I've been asked to sort of talk about the concepts of recovery, resolution, planning. And I'll share with you some of my experience of when I was working in the Australian market and leading the pre-positioning resolution plan for one of the domestically systemically important banks. So in the Australian marketplace, unlike Europe, Australia wasn't really impacted by the 2008 GFC. So the topic of resolution planning, not recovery planning, was very new, with the exception of the investment bank, which everyone would know and already had in place a resolution plan. So if we can go to the next slide, I'll just sort of talk you through the structure of today's presentation. So I'll start by assuming an intermediate to sort of medium level of the topic of resilience risk management. So what I'll do is sort of give you an overview of some of the measures by which the supervisor will look to assess and identify and then intervene in terms of early weakness of banks. Having then established sufficient context for those of you who may not be working in the area of systemic risk management, what I'll then do is then go through some of the key considerations in relation to the topic of recovery and resolution planning, which is a more formal way or more of a regulatory way of saying resilience risk management. Given the fact that recovery and resolution planning has been in place for over a decade in the places such as the UK, one might think that, all of the problems have been addressed, but, as per the August 2024 Bank of England disclosures, you can see that there's still issues in relation to valuations and funding and restructuring options. So it's, important to see that, resolution planning and recovery plannings are living will documents. They're there to adapt to, the environment, be it from a rise of, say, digital banks, be it from a change in the environment, such as, say, artificial intelligence or, potential climatic conditions. So it's a living will document. And then having given you an overview of those, updates, I thought, the purpose of today's conversation is really about, well, how can we sort of, have actuaries working more actively in the space of recovery and resolution planning? And then I'll throw it open to questions and answers. So, Christian, if we could move to the next page. So as I say, for those of you not working necessarily in systemic risk, you may find it quite an odd question as to why are we dealing with the topic of when a bank essentially reaches a recovery point where there may be a trigger in terms of your recovery capacity, or when we get into the resolution space where you've essentially breached the point of non-viability. Well, I mean, the reality is regulators operate with a non-zero failure probability, meaning that they do accept the likelihood of failures, because the alternative in terms of having a zero failure regime would be oppressively costly in terms of the capital required to prevent failure. So it's a logical and commercial outcome in terms of the concept of banks failing. So Christine, if we could just move to the next page. So look, one of the first documents which started to talk about the concept of resilience risk management was the guidance for identification and dealing with weak banks, which was released by the BCBS, or the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, back in July 2015. And on the right-hand side of the slide, you'll see some of the core components which are comprised of that supervisory review process, which is one of the components of the second pillar of the Basel standard. And I think an area where, if I sort of turn my AI machine learning hat on at the moment, we're seeing quite a lot of interest in the sort of early warning signals detection, which is the first node in terms of that supervisory review process. Obviously, supervisors are looking to get more near real time and behavioral data and understand potential volatility or concentrations in the funding profile of the bank, or potentially in terms of weakness which may be emerging in its lending portfolio, for example. Looking at the business model, so looking at sort of earnings at risk in terms of different products, different clients, and different emerging environments. Now, governance and risk management, obviously we've seen a variety of banks fail over the years through the lack of internal management structures and controls and governance, and then obviously tapering off into enterprise-wide stress testing. So look, these are the core kind of processes by which the supervisors are now looking in terms of the identification of weak banks. So Christine, if we could just go to the next page. So just by way of example, of once we've identified potential weak banks, we're now looking at what is the sort of a proactive intervention framework, or what you might see in the UK is called PIF. So on the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see the guidance to the actual supervisory risk intensity model, which recently, back in 2020, replaced the PERS and the SOARS model, which was used for looking at systemic risk associated with banks. And you can see down there some of the concepts which I just referred to back in the 2015 paper. And on the right-hand side, what you'll see is that there is a tiering in terms of how the actual supervisor looks at assessing the bank, whether you're looking at a systemically important institution versus a non-systemically important institution. And then through those, those early warning signals, you'll essentially get a higher level of escalation in terms of the supervisor having more of a scrutiny in terms of your business model, in terms of your earnings, in terms of your forecasted capital adequacy. So look, if we go to the next page, as I say, one might sort of draw the conclusion that failure is highly unlikely, but as I say, you've obviously seen in the Q1 of last year, you saw the weakness which emerged from Silicon Valley Bank in terms of its lending to the technology sector. And, as part of those lending programs, it wasn't just providing funds, it was doing a kind of a co-equity investment. So there was a weakness in terms of its lending and its structure of those loans. And then with the sort of post-COVID downturn in terms of the technology, that weakness obviously then crystallized into a heightened bad debt. You then obviously had the renormalization of the interest rate environment, which I believe Yash was just talking about, in terms of then the embedded loss on the liquidity portfolio, which was amplified by the Silicon Valley Bank having to sell down to meet the withdrawals because of the concern which was on the lending side of the Silicon Valley balance sheet. This kind of, I suppose, then went within the sort of the financial system in the US, and you had others defaulting, and ultimately Credit Suisse, for example, was undone. Now, arguably Credit Suisse could have been put into a resolution quite a long time ago. It had a number of significant trading losses, which were incurred by the bank, as well as, you know, a number of breaches of its, you know, money laundering legislation to, I believe they were lending to the Bulgarian mafia at one stage. So, look, you know, back to that management side. So, you know, even with the best intentions and all of the robustness of the identification and intervention framework, you know, failures do occur. So if we could just go into the next slide, Christian. So what I'm going to do now is really drill into those key considerations relating to recovery and resolution planning. And as I say, resilience risk management is the kind of the broader non-regulatory terminology. But when we start getting into the specifics around regulation, it's really about the topic of recovery and resolution planning. So look, the first key consideration, I would say, as part of any effective recovery and resolution planning process, is that the topic of recovery and resolution planning needs to be integrated into the bank's internal policies and process. And by that, I mean essentially the stress continuum. So if you look on the slide that I'm demonstrating, you'll see that there's three broad regions. Effectively, you have the crisis prevention region, you have the crisis scenario and early intervention stage, and then you have the resolution stage. So you can think of your crisis prevention region as essentially your business as usual, where you essentially have your risk appetite framework, and you're essentially setting limits based on whether you're looking at your retail credit risk, your wholesale credit risk, whether you're looking at your trading limits as part of your trading book business model. You're essentially setting, let's call it a limit. You can then measure, let's call it your capacity, which is really looking around that kind of regulatory threshold. So whether you're looking at your CET1 ratio, whether you're looking at your LCR, or liquidity coverage ratio, your less stable funding ratio, or your leverage ratio, or internal metrics, you're essentially saying, how much can I perturb my current, you know, portfolio to, you know, still remain within my, let's call it, amber zone? So I'm not getting into a recovery trend. So the way in which you would then transition from your crisis prevention then into your, let's call it, recovery, which is essentially the orange section, is essentially a breach. Oh, now if we could just stay on the previous slide. I know it's getting excited here, but so what we're essentially saying is, you can imagine if we looked at your credit provision, if you saw a spike in terms of your transition from stage one to stage two, you might have a, let's call it, a recovery trigger in terms of transitioning from your crisis prevention into your crisis, you know, scenario where you're having early interventions. Or if, for example, it might be a fraud, for example, you might have a significant operational loss, you might then trigger a recovery strategy, for example. And then if you get further and further out into the spectrum, where you then look at the point of non-viability, which is the part between your recovery plan and your resolution plan, you then essentially trigger into what's known as your resolution planning. Now, the important part between recovery and resolution is that the recovery plan is essentially triggered and run by the internal bank, whereas the resolution planning is then driven by the external resolution authority, which, for example, in the UK, the resolution authority is the Bank of England. In Australia, for example, APRA is both the prudential regulator as well as the resolution authority. So it depends on the environment that you're working as to whether that there's a distinction between looking over the BAU and your crisis scenario, early intervention, and then the resolution horizon. So if we could go on to the next slide, if we talk to the sort of, let's call it, the key considerations of a recovery plan. Effectively, there are sort of, you know, eight core components which I've listed on the slide. The first component looks at, well, what are the critical services that the actual institution is providing to the real economy, for example? So the institution I was working with, they were, you know, critically important in terms of providing trade finance on an international basis, given in Australia it's a commodity-based economy. They're also providing critical services around business payroll, for example, and then also around sort of retail lending. So critical services are really understanding as to what is the financial institution providing to the real economy. And then once you've defined those critical services, how are the critical functions such as your group risk functions, group treasury, and all of the internal machinations of the organization, how do they actually support those critical services which are then being provided to the real economy? In terms of the next core components, in an area where I think there's a lot of opportunities, for actuaries to play is around that kind of scenario narrative and then the indicators, the options, and the recovery capacity associated with it. So typically what you'll be looking at is whether it's a fast-moving or slow-moving scenario, and then whether it's intersected with is this the market-wide, is it an idiosyncratic, or is it combined event? So you could imagine, for example, let's call it a cyber attack on a bank is a fast-moving event. It could be potentially a combined. It could be a sort of a broader kind of a cyber attack, or it could be idiosyncratic to the actual institution based on failings of its internal policy and processes. So then once you've actually looked at that type of scenario occurring, what are the recovery options that I could take to essentially mitigate that? Now, this could be, for example, looking at a sale leaseback of your head office. It could be looking at selling off certain lines of businesses, for example. It could be looking to divest some of your overseas investments. And then once you've essentially gone through those different types of options, what are the ultimate recovery capacity? So how does the sale of let's say, for example, you choose to sell a retail portfolio, that might increase your liquidity coverage ratio by the cash coming in. But if you're having to sell it under a fire sale value, you may have to take a hit in terms of your common equity tier one ratio, for example. So the sort of the scenario narrative, the indicators of that potential scenario occurring, the recovery options, and then the recovery capacity is really a core area where I see actuaries being able to play a role. And then when you get into the third pillar of the current slide, you're then looking more into sort of communications and disclosures, which I suppose is not necessarily a core area of the actuarial profession. But if you look to the bottom of the slide, one of the core elements is around sort of data management. So the BCBS 239 requirements, which looks at critical data elements, traceability, metadata management. Obviously, if you're looking to be able to run different types of scenarios and understand the recovery capacity associated with those scenarios, you need to have robust data management. So, a really critical component of the recovery planning is effective risk data management, which generally comes in the form of the BCBS 239 standard. I've just put a sort of a reference to the BOE's supervisory statement for those of you who might be interested in sort of drilling into more specific details in regards to recovery planning. If we could just go to the next slide. So what I'm showing you here is essentially the core considerations from a resolution planning. So if you look at the left-hand side of the screen, I think it really comes down to that kind of PPP concept. So the objectives of resolution planning are essentially to protect the taxpayer from state-funded bailout. So this is kind of the moral hazard associated with the too large to fail, for example. The second component is really around that critical preservation of critical functions and services during a resolution period. You saw during the global financial crisis or the GFC back in 2008, during that period of market dislocation, there's a real impact from the sort of the trading scandals and the trading, losses, which were, incurred on, various structured finance, such as your CDOs, your CDO squares and other, structured products, that there was a breakdown then in terms of the simple, provision of credit to the real economy to continue the, this business of banking. So that preservation of critical functions is a core component. And then, the third core objective is really around that preventing contagion from spreading within the actual financial sector. So really being able to communicate, which was the sort of leveraging from some of that communication part, which is in your recovery planning. So as I say, what you can see is that there's three core building blocks to the resolution planning, which addresses the adequacy of financial resources, continuity, restructuring, and then coordination and communication. So I think, where the actuaries can have a real, added value is in around the sort of the valuations in resolution. So valuations in resolution is essentially looking at, the potential embedded losses in your balance sheet from an asset perspective. And then, looking at how you actually bail in some of your gone concern capital, which is your tier two capital, and potentially how you write down on your common equity and your additional tier one components of your capital structure. So that valuation's in resolution, which is down under the adequacy of the financial resources. Your funding in resolution is essentially looking at cash flow projections in terms of the maintenance of those critical functions over your resolution period, for example. So, you know, where I see most of the sort of the opportunities for actuaries is around, you know, valuations and funding in resolution. If we go to the next page. So as I said, resolution and recovery planning has been in place in banking institutions for over a decade in the UK. And so, as I say, you might assume that, for example, you know, it all is good and rosy, but you know, the reality is far from that. So, Kristen, if we could just go to the next page. So what I'm showing you on the current slide is essentially an extract from the PRA's second resolvability assessment of the UK banks. And so this report is essentially a sort of an incremental and current state analysis from the first report, which was published by the Bank of England back in 2022. So if you want to sort of look at some of the, what I find interesting in terms of the sample set, if you see that Virgin Money, for example, which at $92 billion is included in the sample set, when you look at the next smallest institution, which is essentially Nationwide, I mean, it's a third the size of Nationwide, and then HSBC, it's only 1/33rd of that institution. So as I was saying, in terms of the sort of the process by which you actually look at a resolution plan, it's not just the size of the institution, but it's the criticality in terms of the actual institution and the function that institution provides in terms of the real economy. So obviously the provision of retail services, which the Virgin Money provides in the UK, is deemed critical, which is then the reason why it's actually providing a resolution plan. I suppose the other point of interest is that you'll see the most common resolution strategy for global institutions is a single point of entry in terms of the bail-in, meaning that you might have one NOC structure, or non-operating holding company, which essentially pushes down the capital and the MREL to the operating entities, where the operating entities then will push up to the NOC structure, essentially the embedded losses, right? Whereas, you know, you can see, for example, on here, you've got HSBC and Santander are using the unconventional multiple point of entry. So, you know, for those of you in the call or at the conference, you know, I'd probably point you to the FSB's 2013 document, which talks about the considerations for resolution strategies, which talks about, you know, sufficiency of less absorbing capacity, you know, operational and legal structures, and then also cross-border coordination and cooperation, which is most likely the reason behind the HSBC and Santander having slightly different resolution strategies when compared to the other institutions on that sample set. So, Christian, if we could go to the next page. What I'm giving you here is just some of the observations in terms of what were listed as, let's call it, shortcomings or areas for improvement. And, you know, you can see on the slide, if we look to the left-hand side, you know, the thematic issues, which are from a sectorial wide perspective, you know, relate to data management and let's call it modeling and sort of sensitivity analysis, which again, I think are some of the core areas where, you know, actuaries have been actively working across the financial institution spectrum for a number of years. And then, as I say, if we go into the bank specific issues, there was one bank, which I won't name and shame, but, you can look into the disclosures that they're still having, you know, issues with regards to those restructuring options. So as I was saying, it could be a sale and lease back of your head office. It could be a divestment of business. It could be a cost reduction in terms of, you know, headcount, for example. All of those kind of options, being able to look at those restructuring and sort of continuity type options and being able to, look at the sort of the funding and the valuations associated with those restructuring options. One bank still can't do that in an efficient manner. Then, as I say, going for areas of, you know, enhancements, stuff relating to resolution resilient contracts. When I was working in the Australian market, Now, APRA is really concerned about, you know, sort of third-party providers such as the cloud providers, and making sure that you have resolution-resilient contracts in the event of a point of non-viability. An institution can still have access to those third-party providers, which essentially support the provision of critical functions into the real economy. So it's not just necessarily some of the funding and valuations, barriers, which I sort of mentioned. There are still some of those legal and contractual, requirements, which, need a bit of enhancement. So, Christian, I think if we can go to the final section, just quickly going through the sort of the, you know, the opportunities for ATRI. So if we could just go to the next slide. So, as I say, I mean, you know, my view is, you know, recovery and resolution planning, you know, whilst it has a variety of stakeholders ranging from, you know, people working in the Treasury Department around the structure of the capital in terms of, you know, loss absorbing capital, looking at funding and resolution, looking at valuations with the, you know, group finance, and, you know, the internal M&A team in terms of restructuring options. I think the core role that the sort of the actuarial profession can bring is around that sort of measurement component and understanding the criticality of those data components, which will ultimately then support, you know, in the case of recovery planning, you know, recovery capacity, looking at recovery options, in the case of resolution planning, valuations and funding and resolution. And then, as I said, you know, in terms of how you make this effective, if you have an integrated approach to recovery and resolution planning, you know, the setting of risk appetite statement, the setting of risk limits, the setting of, you know, risk capacity, again, is a core area which, the skill set of the actuary can be leveraged to, drive capability and capacity within the organizations, which, you know, in the real world, this is certainly a sort of a struggle in terms of being able to support that. So hopefully I've been able to get across the key considerations when you, looking at, you know, designing, building, and then sort of implementing and monitoring our recovery and, resolution planning. So look, I've tried to stick to time. I think I might have gone slightly over time, but happy to throw the over to the floor for questions.
Hi, Stephen. So my question is in relation to I think it was slide 6 or 7, where you were showcasing the recovery framework. So we sort of move from BAU towards an early warning indicator, and then obviously triggering the recovery plan. My question is, because I think you had also touched on sort of when you now trigger the early warning indicator would be the case when we're sort of breaching our BAU risk appetite limits. So I just wanted to find out from your perspective, are we now the limits that you're using to trigger the recovery phase, are you finding that those metrics that are being used to define sort of the recovery phase are aligned with the metrics that are sort of being used to monitor the risk appetite at a BAU level? Or because you also, in the following slide, I think you had mentioned sort of scenario testing, or you're finding that what's being used to sort of define or set the recovery phase or trigger the recovery phase is different to what we're sort of monitoring from a BAU risk appetite perspective?
Yeah, look, that's a great question, and not unexpectedly, you see, you know, various sort of disconnects potentially between, let's call it, your risk appetite framework and then the triggering for your recovery plan. But, you know, in general, you know, the triggering of the recovery plan is a lot more objective. So you might say, for example, one institution might say, okay, if my total absolute expected credit loss goes beyond 5 billion AUD, for example, that triggers my recovery plan. Or if my liquidity coverage ratio drops below, say, 115%, I'm going to now trigger my recovery plan. So I think the thresholds which are for triggering of the recovery plan and your BAU, I think there's quite a close alignment there. The question as to the trigger from going into point of non-viability, I think that's the really hot topic. That's where there seems to be quite a lot of ambiguity, and there's not as objective and as rational as to the trigger from BAU into recovery as from recovery into, you know, the resolution. And I think you kind of saw that kind of play out with a Credit Suisse event in Q1 of 2023. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for your talk. I just wanted to ask if you've got any research paper advice on using AI to predict, like to give early warning indicators, especially using bank supervisory.
Well, look, I mean, if you share, sorry, I can't see you or hear your name, but if you share your email address with the organisers, I can certainly send you some information around that. I mean, I don't know what your Saab, you know, domestically is doing in terms of its supervisory technology program, but you're certainly seeing in Australia with its 5-year data roadmap and looking at sort of soup tech type approaches. This is predominantly more on the predictive artificial intelligence rather than the sort of the generative AI, which is more recent. But yeah, I'm happy to share some of the topics around soup tech and that kind of approach. More than happy. That's it's a really good question.
Thank you. Hi, Stephen. A related question, I suppose, to the AI and predictability. Currently, banks are, I suppose, responsible for kind of their monitoring and determining those thresholds for going into the recovery stage. From a supervisory point of view, how frequent should that supervisory review take place from a resolution point of view? So assessing key metrics on a monthly basis, annual, what's your view on that?
So just as I'm clear, are you talking about the metrics in terms of the resolution plan as in the point of non-viability? Is that
correct?
What you're talking
correct.
About? Or so, are you talking about the recovery, or are you talking about BAU? Because I think the frequency, as per the slide which I shared, the sort of the proactive intervention framework, I mean that, you know, and there's a similar kind of process that you have in the PRA. So, you know, if the institution is, you know, well within its, let's call it recovery, let's call it within its risk appetite, you know, there'll be like a quarterly review, for example. If there's a sort of an early warning trigger, you might see that there's an uplift in terms of the commercial real estate delinquency, for example, then there might be an increase in terms of the frequency. So, you know, as you progressively get closer to a recovery trigger, the frequency by which they will monitor it will increase, if that makes sense.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's not a one goal.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's give Stephen a round of applause. Thanks for the session.